Good morning, everyone. Once again, the National Broadcasting Company presents another in its regular series of reports of the news at home and abroad. Our staff correspondents are standing by here and overseas. For our first report, we take you to Cairo and Grant Parr.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. When troops of various services meet on leave in Cairo, one bone of contention is who has the most dangerous job. In other words, what outfit demands the most courage and daring of its members? I couldn't answer that question, but it does seem to me that the boys in the artillery section should at least be nominated. During the last war, artillery men in France often sat down in the grove of trees well behind the front and proceeded to shell the enemy. They had little to worry about except shells from enemy guns, and other services usually got most of those. But in the desert, the gunners have never known anything like that. They've played a vital and often decisive part. They've often carried the day, but they've paid in dead and wounded, in flesh and blood, for the toll they've taken of enemy armor. An artilleryman operates his gun, a 25-pounder, we'll say, virtually in the open. He has a small shield, but it only protects him while he is actually behind the gun. And there is ammunition to be carried, which puts him out in the open with no protection at all. When the guns can be used behind a ridge, it helps. But ridges in the desert have a way of being absent when they're most needed. Quotations from awards just made to members of a Royal Artillery Field Regiment indicate the hazards of a gunner's life. One citation reads in part, "The next day his troop was overrun, but although his sergeant major was killed by his side and he himself was slightly concussed by the same shell, Captain Wick saved two of his guns and withdrew inside the battery perimeter." Another citation says, "When his troop was attacked by Mark III and Mark IV tanks and heavily machine gunned and shelled, Captain Boyd was wounded twice, but took command of a gun when another man was killed. He continued to fight his guns until two of them were put out of action and all his ammunition was expended." And again, "When another officer was knocked out, Lieutenant Dawes ran across to the guns over ground swept by machine gun fire and took charge of all the guns until they were knocked out by enemy shell fire." These stories speak for themselves. Artillery fire knocks out many tanks, but it takes direct hits to do it. Gunners may be killed by shrapnel from shells bursting many feet away, by airstropping, or by infantry sniping. Yet in battles with tanks, they've usually come out ahead. The artillery outfit seldom gets a vacation either. The Alamein front was quiet yesterday, but the guns were busy as usual. I now return you to New York.
Our next report comes to us from the British capital. We switch you now across the Atlantic to London and John McVane.
This is London. If anything like a second front is being planned, the security has been well kept. But without knowing anything about what Mr. Churchill and the service chiefs intend, people over here have an indefinable feeling that something is in the wind. This feeling may be just a feeling without any basis, but it has charged the atmosphere of England with expectancy, and the average Britisher is once again ready to take and give hard blows. The British are continuing the process of tightening up their civil defenses, because if real war again flares up in Western Europe, the fire watchers, home guards, air raid wardens, and all the rest will have plenty to do. Fire watchers are being given special lectures, and the sound of the air raid alarms has taken some of the dullness out of the duty of spending one or two nights a week in readiness to go on rooftop duty. In the next few days, all London residents are going to be canvassed and told what special duties they'll have to undertake in an invasion. Women who aren't doing anything else will be used to organize food centers. Women are taking more and more part in the fighting services to free men for the army or the home guard. In the past few nights, the first all-woman searchlight battery in London has been at action stations. The great searchlight and its machinery is entirely controlled by girls in battle dress. Before they were given the responsibility, the girls had to learn to manipulate the beam, carry out repairs, and recognize all types of friendly and enemy aircraft. You know that home guards are taking over anti-aircraft batteries. They're getting more and more efficient and complicated weapons for the day when the army carries out its mobile task on the continent and the defense of England is left up to the home guard. The British believe that Laval's campaign to recruit workers to Germany has failed so badly that he'll soon have to use outright force. Laval promised the Germans they'd get about 350,000 French workers to help solve their labor problem. The campaign he began a few weeks ago has only succeeded in getting about 12,000 Frenchmen to go to Germany. Laval closes factories in France and threatens to withdraw ration cards of workers who won't go to Germany. At the same time, he tells the French workers that in Germany, they'll get high wages, cheap lodging, and paid holidays. British sources point out that once the French workers get into Germany, the conditions aren't fulfilled, but then there isn't anything the Frenchmen can do about it. Vichy has talked about the repatriation of French prisoners of war, but so far not a single prisoner has been sent back to France under Laval's scheme. For many months, there has been a dribble of prisoners coming back to France, but they're the very sick or permanently disabled, and the Germans consider them useless mouths, so they get rid of them. For some time, it's been reported that Laval is going to try the especially foul scheme of taking the 100,000 Spanish Republican refugees in France and handing them over to the Germans or the Franco government. Either way, they'd be condemned to death, torture, and imprisonment. A group of distinguished English men and women, headed by the Duchess of Athol, Lord Cecil of Chelwood, and the Master of Balliol College, Oxford, are appealing to the United States and the countries of Latin America to protest to Vichy. And today, the Yorkshire Post asserts that the Spanish refugees are outside the armistice terms. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Our next report on the war comes to us from neutral Sweden. Our staff correspondent, David Anderson, gives us his summary of the war as seen from Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. The talk about a second land front has now entered upon its third stage. In the first one, we found the Allies doing most of the talking, with the Germans denying the possibility of the Allies to open up another front. The second stage was begun last week when Dr. Goebbels said that the Allies may be forced to open up a second front, although at the same time Mussolini was saying that a second front could not be opened. The third stage now is marked by the question, what will be the political and military effects of a second front? In other words, it is no longer a question of if, when, and where, but rather what follows. When talking of a second front, our thoughts naturally are concentrated on the most likely battleground. In this case, France, with a very slight possibility of Norway coming into the picture. And so, as is to be expected, the reports from Vichy today are the ones which call our attention to this third stage in the conversation. At present, the wildest rumors are supposed to be circulating in France concerning the Second Front. Exactly what the nature of these rumors may be is not given, but it is said that the recently intensified British propaganda directed to France has been interpreted as a nerve warfare just before the beginning of the attack on the French coast. Then, too, the recent acts of sabotage and attacks on French Nazis and Germans have tended to create a feeling of tension. It is recognized that a well-organized communistic and de Gaulle movement exists whose purpose it would be to support an Allied front in France. It is no wonder, then, that the men of Vichy and German occupying forces have shown concern. According to Vichy reports, it is generally believed there that the opening stages of a second front would result in the landing of parachute troops inside the country. This, they say, will be necessary because the French coast is too well fortified to make a successful landing possible. As you will recall, the Germans, too, have recently been emphasizing the strength of their defenses on the Western Front. The latest example is given in a report from Berlin today in which it states the Dutchman disregarded the order not to go near the shore. He stepped on a landmine and was killed. This report is supposed to direct our attention to the fact that the whole coast is thoroughly mined. Well, anyway, if the Allies should land troops inside the country, the men of Vichy fear that the French people would aid the Allies. At that time, it is said that Vichy will open an appeal for common order, threatening the civilians with severe reprisals if they participate in the fighting. Part of the discussion of what Vichy would do in such a case is undoubtedly being gone into between Laval and the German authorities now in Paris. As far as the occupied zone is concerned, Vichy does not expect any immediate military action here in connection with a second front. They consider this region to be too far from the British bases. But if the Allies should succeed in getting that far, they say that it will be defended in the same manner as Syria and Madagascar. In this connection, it is reported that Admiral Darlan is now on a tour of inspection of the defenses in the free zone. To mention briefly the tone in Norway, the other possible region for a second front, the Quisling press is reiterating Quisling's own words in a speech he made recently. He said then that a civil war would break out in Norway in case a second front was opened in that country. In that, I think we are all agreed. So there is the picture, one stage advanced in all of this talk about a second front. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Richard Harkness of the Washington Bureau of the Philadelphia Inquirer is ready to give you our final report on the news of the world. We take you now to Washington.
We've just heard reports from battlefronts all over the world. To military observers in Washington, developments on these far-flung fronts make August one of the most important months of the whole war. It is their considered opinion that August may even decide the war, or at least decide whether it will be relatively short or long and hard. Before August is passed, we should know whether the Russians can keep Hitler out of the Caucasus. We should know whether the German drive has been stopped, or whether Timoshenko's army has been able to turn the striking power of the Nazi thrust. If the Germans can be stopped by September 1st, and belief here is that they will be, the United Nations will have taken a long step forward to victory. Then, too, Japan probably will decide before the end of August whether or not to attack the Russian rear in Siberia. The United Korean Committee of America reported today that Japan will turn on Russia before autumn. The Japs have heavy troop concentrations in Manchuria. One of Japan's most able military men, General Yamashita, commands the troops now holding a dagger at Russia's back. There's ample reason to believe the information supplied by the Korean Committee. Months before Pearl Harbor, this group informed the American government how and when the Japs would attack Hawaii. Military observers here also believe that August will bring a decision in North Africa. The British and Germans are locked in a stalemate now, with both sides bringing up supplies and jockeying for position. But a decisive battle is expected before the month has gone. If the Allies can win on these three fronts this month, if they succeed only in holding the enemy, we will be well on our way to final victory. And looking forward to that day of victory, Wendell Willkie has offered the country a set of principles to fight for, a creed for victory he says should guide us. Willkie proposes, one, that America must fight this war in union with other countries until the last vestige of totalitarianism and aggression is destroyed. Two, that no matter how painful or how long and arduous the road to complete victory may be, we must tread it with no thought of appeasement and no hope of peace until we reach its end. And third, that when this war is over, we must set up institutions and methods of international, political, and economic cooperation and adjustment among all the nations of the earth. While there is reason to view the war today with restrained optimism, we must face the fact that we're losing the Battle of the Atlantic to Hitler's submarines. For the Navy officially announces the sinking of four more Allied vessels. Our loss of ships since Pearl Harbor now jumps to 412. Reports of these latest sinkings reveal that Hitler has unleashed a new war of terror on the high seas. For the crews of two of the four vessels were wantonly and cruelly machine-gunned by Nazi U-boats. Seven men were killed, and seven more wounded and sent to sea in open lifeboats. Here may be the answer to Hitler's undersea warfare. Simon Lake, the 75-year-old inventor of the modern submarine, has urged the Navy to let him build a fleet of giant underwater cargo boats to cut down sinkings. Lake proposes to build submarines 395 feet long, submarines so big that they would carry 7,500 tons of freight or 2,500 fighting men anywhere in the world. Secretary of Navy Frank Knox says that such a mammoth submarine is entirely feasible. He admits it would be comparatively safe, but the Navy isn't doing anything about it. Lake took his plans to the Navy and was told to go to the Maritime Commission. The inventor went to the Maritime Commission and he was sent back to the Navy. Hopping mad over what he calls a runaround, Lake says the trouble with our government officials is that they're afraid to take responsibility for anything new. Before the day is over, we may know the verdict in the case of the eight Nazi spies. The military commission received its decision yesterday and sent it to the White House for presidential review. Also, Mr. Roosevelt is expected to announce today that he is vetoing the Farm Bloc synthetic rubber bill. And that's all from Washington.
And so ends this morning's roundup of the news of the world. Today we heard from our staff reporters Grant Parr in Cairo, John McVane in London, David Anderson in Stockholm, and Richard Harkness from our newsroom in Washington. For all the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.